Welcome to Current State. I'm your host, Kyle Malin, filling in for Mark Bayshore, who is on vacation. I am the editor of the MERS newsletter and have been following state government and politics for our publication for the last 15 years. Glad to be with you here today. We have a great show planned for you today. We're going to talk to participants and staff from the exchange student program called Youth for Understanding. They facilitate international experiences for students all over the world, and they started here in Michigan. And the artwork on album covers took an artsy turn in 1967.
Andy Warhol, you get a banana on an album cover. That's pretty different than Sonny and Cher's photograph and Before a Tree.
Coming up, Scott Pohl talks with Doug Showquist. He's the curator of an exhibit of iconic album covers now at the Lansing Mall. All that's coming up, but first, we're going to dive into one of the more competitive state congressional districts here in Michigan. It's the 7th Congressional District. The 7th and the 1st have traditionally, over the last several years, been one of the more competitive districts in the state. Republicans and Democrats from Washington, D.C. have put a very keen focus on these districts. With the upcoming elections in November, the Republicans currently hold a 246 to 186 seat advantage in the state house. There are some vacancies in there, but roughly the math works out that the Democrats need to take about 31, 32, 33 seats in order to take majority based on how all these other vacancies turn out. And the focus is going to be on the 7th Congressional here in the state of Michigan. The Democrat that the Democrats hope will carry the day for them in the 7th Congressional District is Gretchen Driscoll. She is a state representative out of Saline, and she's joining us on the other end of the line. Good morning, Representative. How are you?
Great, Kyle. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. Thanks for joining us on the program today. Why don't you give our listeners a little bit of your background on who you are and where you come from?
Sure. I come from New York. I moved to Michigan 28 years ago with a young family and got involved in the community of Saline as a volunteer. And that led to, we built some a rec center as chair of the fundraising committee there and really believe in getting involved as a community member, as a volunteer. And that led to being on city council and ultimately mayor for 14 years in Saline. I do come from a background of military service, multiple generations, and one of my core values is giving back to the community. So I've been very honored and privileged to have the opportunity to represent not only Saline for 20 years, but also now, I'm currently in my second term in the State House in Washtenaw County, which wraps around Ann Arbor, basically from the northeast corner of Washtenaw County all the way to the western side, and down to Manchester and Saline, so Chelsea, Whitmore Lake area. And I do have a background originally in accounting. I've passed my CPA and worked as an accountant in Washington, D.C. before I came here 28 years ago, and I'm currently a commercial realtor now, in addition to being a state representative.
Now, tell our listeners why you were interested in running for this congressional seat.
So, when I first ran, I will tell you I was nonpartisan for 20 years, and I do have the support of both the previous congresspeople, Joe Schwartz and Mark Sauer, because I worked very closely with them on good policy. I'm hearing from my citizens and my constituents that they're feeling underrepresented or not represented, actually, in Washington, D.C., and there's a lot of frustration with what's been happening in our economy and education and just general that we could be having better representation in Washington. And I experienced some of the same frustration. As I mentioned, I worked for many years to help our communities, and I was involved actually across the state level with policymaking and federal from a local government perspective over the years I was in local government. So I do have a broad range of backgrounds that would help contribute to the communities and our citizens, and I'm running to be the voice for them and really represent the communities on the ground and have come from the perspective of representing the people of the district and making sure that we make sure that their jobs, we're in a big transition in the economy here with our manufacturing transition, and a lot of people are having job dislocation and there's a lot of frustration with what's been happening and their representation in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in for Mark Bearshore today. We've got State Representative Gretchen Driscoll on the other end of our line. She is the Democratic candidate in the 7th Congressional District. You just mentioned jobs. Would you say that jobs and the economy are the top issues that you're hearing from the constituents in the 7th?
Yeah, most definitely. I've been visiting a lot of areas in the 7th, and for those that don't know, that 7th is seven counties. It includes my current state house district in Washtenaw County. It also includes the four counties along the Ohio border, so Monroe, Lenawee, Hillsdale, Branch, and it goes up to Jackson and Eden County, ultimately to the southwest border of the city of Lansing. It's a big district with a lot of smaller communities that have had a transition in their manufacturing economy, and there's, as I mentioned, dislocated workers that are really, the communities are in transition, and really jobs in the economy. And, you know, as mayor, I experienced this transition. We have what was a Ford plant at one point in Saline. That facility did transition into a Forcia, is now leasing the building, and it's 1.5 million square feet. It's a very large building, actually one of the largest of its kind in the country. In the world. And also, we lost a major manufacturer, R&B Machine Tools, while I was, it was bought by another company, and then the book of business was sent to other states. So we do have a transition that's going on, and I've been visiting with chambers and local communities, senior centers, just any community organizations that are involved with what's happening at the local level, because that's really where the rubber hits the road, and we have not been having our voices heard effectively in Washington.
Now, you mentioned jobs in the economy. One of the big issues that we've been hearing on the presidential stage, at least here in Michigan, is the stance on trade and their support for NAFTA and TPP. What is your position on NAFTA and whether Congress should approve this Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal?
Well, the incumbent, Mr. Wahlberg, has actually said that NAFTA was good for us. And here in the 7th, that we actually lost jobs, manufacturing jobs. And there, like I said, there's a lot of people that are in transition because of that in a very significant way with their economic fortune or frustration with what's happening. And so NAFTA actually was not good for some of especially our automotive workers. And then, so we need to fix NAFTA and make sure that, we don't just ship jobs overseas. So that's one of the things that we really need to be working on. And I plan on doing that at the local level, providing opportunities for training, retraining, because there is some gaps here right now in the way the manufacturing is transitioning. And, TPP is much of the same in that it's not addressing currency manipulation. Our car companies are not supportive of it right now because it is not helping our car companies in particular with a currency manipulation position. And, I came out right from the get-go when it was first, there was a legislation last year to fast-track the legislation for, or fast-track the agreement and the negotiating ability to fast track that, to give it to the president. And Mr. Wahlberg voted for fast tracking. It's called the TPA. It is a really important issue in our district, and we do have a lot of work to do to make sure that we get good paying jobs back in the communities in the 7th Congressional District. And I do have a track record of doing that as mayor of the community of Saline. We, as I mentioned earlier, have quite a few businesses, and Saline has been very successful in working with the businesses to make sure we get good-paying jobs there and keep as much economic activity as possible in the community.
Representative Driscoll, just to be clear here then, do you think the TPP just needs more work, or do you think that Congress should just reject it and throw it in the dumpster?
I think that I'm not supporting TPP.
Okay. So you're just not, okay. Here's another issue that's come out on the presidential stage. Donald Trump's alleged wall to Mexico. to build a wall along the southern border to keep legal immigrants from crossing into the United States. Do you believe that we should build a wall along the southern border?
I believe that we should have secure borders, and I think that there are tools to do that. And I do think that we need to have a comprehensive immigration reform as part of that whole process of making sure that we have a country that works with, has a good immigration policy, because we do need to be, our country is based on supporting, a lot of the entrepreneurs that come and start businesses are foreign-born. There's a lot of documentation that there is huge economic benefit from diversity and entrepreneurs from other countries and workers from other countries. So we do need to have secure borders, and we do need to have a comprehensive immigration reform. And I will tell you that there has been bipartisan effort out of the Senate in the past, and I think that's one of the things that we people are interested in seeing happen, is less partisanship and more working towards solving the issues that are outstanding for our country.
But does a wall get us there? Do you think in the end that a wall would help us?
Well, who's going to pay for the wall?
Mexico is, right?
I haven't heard that. Have you heard that?
Well, Donald Trump seems to think Mexico is going to pay for the wall.
Well, when Mexico says they're going to pay for the wall, then let's have that conversation. But I think, we have national debt. I think saying somebody's going to pay for a wall when nobody said that they are is a lot of hyperbole. So I think we have a lot of things to work on, and I think we should be working on what's most important to my constituents, which is jobs and the economy.
One of the other issues that have come up, particularly in the last year, is Syrian refugees. And I just read an article about how the Oakland County executive, Brooks Patterson, wants to try and sue the federal government to keep Syrian refugees from being located in his county. That whether Syrian refugees are located in the United States or in Mexico or in Michigan is dictated by federal policy. And since you're running for federal office, I wanted to get your position. Are you okay with the current process and how we're relocating Syrian refugees in Michigan, since we are the second largest state in the country for accepting such refugees?
Well, there are communities here already. So, law-abiding citizens, and there is a vetting process for the refugees that come into our country, and it's a long process. So I do think that as long as we are smart and tough about how we welcome our refugees, but again, that's part of what our country is based on. We've had a history of in our country of welcoming refugees, and one of being I'm trying to remember the Statue of Liberty's quote at the bottom.
Give us your needy and your poor.
These are young children, so I think we really need to be. There is a very significant vetting process. If there is concern, should we be looking at addressing the vetting process? But I certainly do not believe that we should be closing our doors to refugees. I think that one of our values in our country that we're most proud of is, being a welcoming country to people from all walks of life, because that's one of our core values. And we need to have a safe country, and we need to make sure that we protect our citizens. But I do believe there is a way to do that and still be welcoming to refugees.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of MERS, filling in for Mark Bayshore. We've been speaking with State Representative Gretchen Driscoll. She's the Democratic candidate in the 7th Congressional District. We only have a few minutes left in the program, but I did want to talk about some of the ads that have already started running in the 7th Congressional and here in the Lansing media market. We've started to see plenty of them. There's a ad that the incumbent, Tim Walberg, has run that says that you are lying to constituents about whether you are a real estate broker or not. I'd like you to have an opportunity to address that and just kind of clear the record on whether you're a real estate broker or not.
So thank you for asking that question. I do really, it's very important to have a clear explanation out there because advertisements can be very misleading. I do have a license to practice as a real estate agent, and broker is used interchangeably nationally. As a matter of fact, on our website where we keep all our profiles for all the realtors and our listings of properties, the box, there's only one box to check. It says agent/broker. There is a license out there for a managing broker or an associate broker. I have never called myself that, and that's why you have used the word broker, and that, as I mentioned, is an agent and broker used interchangeably throughout the country. So I appreciate the opportunity to clear the air on that. Again, I do have a real estate license to practice real estate.
And just to be clarified, you are a commercial real estate broker or agent, and in that commercial right. real estate industry, the terms broker and agent are used interchangeably, where maybe if you're just dealing in residential, it's not necessarily as interchangeable.
Right.
Okay.
Well, all I know is that on our website, it's agent/broker, and when this issue came up, we talked about it at length with the Board of Realtors, and this is a national standard, and it's a non-issue. So being made into an issue that isn't necessary. I think, again, the people that I talk to out in the district when I go door-to-door are interested in what the person that represents them in Washington, D.C. will be doing for them. And I do have a track record of bringing business to the communities that I work in, partnering with them on the ground for coming up with innovation solutions for solving challenging problems and working alongside the people in the communities that I represent. And I've been doing that in the State House also. And I know I have a track record of working hard and, most importantly, listening to the people that I represent.
Do you believe that the Congressman Tim Walberg is being honest with his constituents?
No. I think he's saying that he's come out against this the TPP recently. He voted to fast-track it, as I mentioned. That was a vote that was, I think it was like 218 in favor and 211 against. So if he was really not supportive of the TPP, he didn't need to be a yes vote. And he's voted for every trade deal that has been put in front of him since he was elected. So his actions are totally different than what his statements are. And he's put out information saying that he wants to protect Social Security and Medicare. And again, if people look at how he voted, he has not voted to protect those. He has actually voted to privatize those and also to, the organization that supported him in his race against Joe Schwartz is a significant advocate for privatizing Social Security. So I think people need to do their own research, but I definitely... I think actions speak louder than words, and I urge everybody that's interested in this race to look at how I voted and what my actions are versus and what I say and what his actions are and what he says.
All right. We've been speaking with Representative Gretchen Driscoll, who is running in the 7th congressional race. Thanks for joining us on Current State this morning.
Well, it was great to talk with you, and thanks for the opportunity. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too. And don't forget that we have a forum hosted by the League of Women Voters in Chelsea tonight at 6:30 at the Chelsea Retirement Community. If you're interested in learning more about this race or have your own questions for Representative Driscoll, you may be able to ask him at that time. It was founded in Michigan and now has presence in over 50 countries. Youth for Understanding is an international exchange program, and we're going to speak with the local field manager, as well as a host parent and an exchange student who is here from Germany. That's later this hour on Current State. The earliest album covers were simple, mostly portraits of the band with conventional lettering styles, but in the mid-1960s, that started to change. Current State's Scott Pohl is here with more on an exhibit of iconic album covers from that era. So where is this exhibit, Scott?
Well, it's at the Keys to Creativity Gallery in the Lansing Mall. The owner, Larry Groot, asked Doug Schoquist to curate a show called The Golden Age of Album Art, and you can see it through October 6th. This is right in my wheelhouse, Kyle. This is my era of rock and roll. I met up with the two of them to check it out, and Showquist explained to me how the tide started to turn with the Velvet Underground in 1967.
You know, you get Andy Warhol, you get a banana on an album cover, right? That's pretty different than Sonny and Cher's photograph and Before a Tree. Or you'll get, Disraeli Gears that came out later that year, and Sgt. Pepper's in June of 1967. We're going to celebrate the 50th anniversary of that album cover. That's the first album cover to have printed lyrics in it, and also the first album cover to have Hindu images in it. If you look at some of this other album art from 1967, like Jimi Hendrix's Axis, Bold as Love, the artwork is all Hindu images in there. And you have artwork that's on their Satanic Majesty's Request by the Rolling Stones that has a lenticular technology on the front that makes it look 3D. So, you know, artists were just going crazy, just opening up the whole thing. And you know that in 1967, the whole field is going to just, it's all changed. It's all gone from the normal.
When I look at these five album covers, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, Axis, Bold as Love. Now if a six turned out to be nine, I don't mind. Disraeli Gears. I've been waiting so long to be where I'm going in the sunshine of your love. The Andy Warhol cover for the Velvet Underground. I'm waiting for my man. 26 dollars in my hand. And the Rolling Stones' Satanic Majesty's Request. I almost don't need to see more to know that this is the golden age of album cover artwork.
Yeah, I think that's right. And if you look at the other turning point in the life cycle of this golden age, if you look at what happens after 1983, you can see that there's a return to portrait photography. If you take in the 1980s, the best-selling albums by Madonna or Michael Jackson or Tears for Fears or Lionel Richie, it's all portrait photography. And so what's disappeared is artwork. And I think one of the distinguishing characteristics of this exhibit is that, the art directors of these record companies hired artists, very enlightened artists who worked in traditional mediums like watercolor and acrylic and oil on canvas and even woodcuts. And the Jethro Tull 1969 album, Stand Up, is actually a woodcut by Jimmy Grashaw, a New York-based artist. And, you know, you look at some of the stuff by Rick Griffin and some of the others, or Santana's first 1969 album, and you do any comparative analysis with what comes after in 1984 and 85, 86, it's a very stark contrast. It's about artwork and diminished use of photography.
Why did we go back to the portraits then?
I'm not sure. I think the portraits are coinciding with the video format. I think when MTV kind of hit the stage, in 1982, I think people started moving in that direction. And of course, 82 is when CDs started to hit the marketplace and the artwork becomes smaller and smaller. And the video is kind of taking the precedence over the actual artwork.
Larry Groot, I want to ask you about why you wanted this exhibit here at Keys to Creativity Gallery in the Lansing Mall. How does it fit in with the other exhibits you've hosted?
Well, this is our first more educational exhibit that we've promoted here. It was having single artist shows, that type of thing, shows that would support a poetry exhibit that we had. But this was the first kind of thing that had some experiential aspect of our generation and then what this art meant to the culture. And one of my big takes from here is that when I was in school, when I was in high school, when I was in college, we didn't hear anything about Hindu art. This is a canvas that we had and a medium that we had to learn about what's going on in the rest of the world. And in that time of the late 60s and 70s, it was exploring, you know, what else is out there. And I think that's from the viewers that are coming in here and seeing that that's one of their big takes.
We're talking with Larry Groot of the Keys to Creativity Gallery in the Lansing Mall and with Doug Showquist about the exhibit he has curated here on the Golden Age of Album Art. We're going to take a look around now. The next one along the way is an album called New Generation by the Chambers Brothers, and this is really an intricate, involved piece of artwork.
Come let us gather, one and all. Whatever your age means nothing at all. Come let us toast with glasses full of love. Come let us toast to the saving of our dove.
The most complex album cover ever produced during the so-called Golden Age, and the artist is Matty Klarvine, who has produced many of the works actually for groups during that period as well. But, you know, one of the distinguishing characteristics, again, of this exhibit is the international content that is in the artwork itself. And there's a lot of Asian themes and African themes and European and American themes. And these artists that are doing this artwork are exploring. They are idealistic. They are very enlightened people who embraced a global perspective before we even started talking about global perspectives as a thing in education, as a concept in education.
I'm not sure where we're fitting in at this particular stop with regard to the timeline of 1967 to 1983, but there's another thing that has begun showing up on album covers in this time frame, and that's nudity on album covers.
We have some of that in this exhibit, and we have some in the section on African cultural themes, for example, and again, an artwork by Matty Klarvine, who's a German artist. Did a painting oil on canvas back in 1961. It's called The Annunciation, but it's a painting that was used on Santana's 1970 album, Abraxas.
Got your spell on me, baby. Got your spell on me, baby. Yes, you got your spell on me, baby.
It's an interpretation of the Annunciation story that you find in the Bible, but it is from the perspective of from Africa. So, for example, you know, if you look at the artwork itself, you have a black Virgin Mary, and you have Gabriel, the angel, is red astride a conga drum. And they've asked, I think in a Rolling Stone article, once they asked Matty Klarvine about this painting itself and why the conga drums, and he simply said, because if you were in Africa, this is how you communicate. So this is how the Annunciation would be communicated. If you look at the jazz artist Miles Davis' Bitches Brew album, you'll notice that there is something very distinctive about it that is similar to what you have in the Abraxas album by Santana, right? And that is the Wota Abe Nomad. Maddie Clarvine, the artist, had actually lived in the country of Niger with Wodaabe nomads, and these are, and he included them in many of his paintings. And it not only adorns the Bitches Brew album cover or the Abraxas album cover, but even the 1980s cover of National Geographic.
You've chosen the cover of the Kansas album Left Overture. Why have you selected this album cover?
I use this one first because I think in terms of European cultural themes, if you look back in history, the Romantics, which is Romanticism is a 19th century movement in Europe and North America, but the Romantics were very interested in the culture of the Middle Ages, and they tried to recreate it in their artwork, they tried to recreate it in their literature, and I thought that this is a perfect example of a Romanticism theme. And you see in the Left Overture album, you see a monk who's struggling to write out, you know, some music lines on a scroll in a Romanesque scriptorium or, you know, library or something like that. It's very, it just oozes that romanticism, as does that artwork on the Moody Blues album, where you have this emphasis on magic and alchemy. And
the Moody Blues album, Every Good Boy Deserves Favor.
Yes, yep. Philip Travers is the artist there, who's done most of the Moody Blues album covers. Another feature of the 19th century romantic movement, though, in Europe, is a dread of technological and scientific progress. It's very different from the Enlightenment period, and they were fearful that science and technology would be the ruin of humankind rather than leading us forward or propelling us forward into a state of happiness and perfection. And I think these album covers that I've chosen here, especially the Queen album cover and the Emerson, Lake & Palmer album cover, Brain Salad Surgery, kind of reflect that romantic dread of science and technology and the possibilities that it can create biomechanical images, or it can create, you know,
or robots taking
robots
over the world.
Taking over the world, yeah.
Out of all of the Elton John album covers, the cover of Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy might be the most intricate artwork from his catalog.
No doubt about it. And the artist is Alan Aldridge, who also did some work for the Beatles. There is a book out on the Beatles that was all illustrated by Alan Aldridge. But it is very intricate, and it's reminiscent in my mind of Bosch, Hieronymus Bosch, who did a lot of intricate paintings like the Garden of Delight. And you can see that the artwork by Alan Aldridge, however, is more fanciful than it is religious, like the Bosch stuff. But I think it's Bosch influence.
On Sunday, September 25th, there will be an event here at the gallery that I want to give you a chance to tell us about, Larry Groot. Tell us about an evening of beneficial blues. Thornetta Davis is going to be here in the Lansing Mall performing?
Yes, Thornetta Davis, Mike Scorry, and Jeff Shope are going to be our premier band for that event. And what we're doing is trying to build up money for arts residency projects. So we're just trying to build up funds so that we can bring arts back into the schools in a more deliberative manner than what is presented now.
Is that normally after hours on a Sunday?
6 o'clock, the mall closes. So it's going to be after hours. We have this whole little wing here right out inside of Macy's. It's called the Macy's Court, and we have this whole area to work with.
On Sunday the 25th at 6 o'clock, the Keys to Creativity Gallery in the Lansing Mall will host an evening of beneficial blues with singer Thornetta Davis. Doug Showquist will start things at 6 o'clock with a talk about the exhibit he has curated here at the gallery called The Golden Age of Album Art. If you're not able to attend on Sunday, the exhibit is going to be here in the Lansing Mall until October 6th. We've been talking with Doug Showquist and the gallery's owner, Larry Groot. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
The best way to thrive in our increasing multicultural global society is to become immersed in other cultures. That's the belief that drives Youth for Understanding, a nonprofit educational exchange program that started in Michigan and is now in more than 50 countries. With me in the studio today is Deb Fry. She is the YFU Field Director for South Central Michigan. Welcome, Deb.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Linda Unkefer, a host parent and volunteer with YFU. Good morning.
Good morning.
And the exchange student she's hosting from Germany. He is Fabian Hainig. Welcome to Current State.
Hello.
All right, we'll start with you here, Deb. Youth for Understanding, it's an international organization. It started in Ann Arbor. What's the story? How did it start?
It started back in 1948, really, when our founder, Rachel Andreessen, was in Amsterdam attending a council of churches when the city lights of Amsterdam came on for the first time after the war ended. And she said, I never want to see the lights go out again. And so that was her mission.
And so the mission was then to bring students from other countries to the United States and students from the United States to other countries.
Yes.
And so how many countries are we talking about we have partnerships here with?
We have over 70 partner countries right now.
Wow, that's quite a few countries. And so explain how this partnership works out. If you wanted to be a host parent or your child is interested in going to other countries, how does this whole process work?
So if you're interested in being a host family or a host parent, what we do is there are exchange students available from over our 70 partner countries. You can choose the country that you're interested in or the student type of student that you're interested in and decide to host them.
Now, is there application fees and costs and all that involved?
No, there are no application fees to be a host family.
So if I wanted to host a child or a student from Europe or Australia or China, do I get a choice in that matter? Or?
You do. You get to choose the country that you want to host from.
Okay.
You choose a student based on who you think will fit with your family the best. Do we want to give you and the student the best experience that they can have here in the United States? And so if your family is a soccer family, you know, you can pick a European soccer or a Brazilian soccer kid or another, you know, from another country. Someone who will fit into your busy soccer life. If you're interested in music, we have musicians who apply. It's all based on what you would like to bring to your family dynamics.
Linda, let me talk to you here. Now, your family has hosted several exchange students from my understanding. Tell me how many you've brought into your home.
We've had 11 students.
11 students.
Yeah.
Now, it's always one at a time, right? You don't
We've actually, three times we've hosted two at a time.
Really?
YFU has a rule they can't be from the same country.
Okay.
So it gets really multicultural.
I'm sure. Now, you live in Napoleon, right?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. And that's by Jackson, sort of?
Yeah, kind of southeast of Jackson.
Okay. And tell me what countries your students have come from mostly.
Most of them have been from Germany, but we had a girl from Finland, a girl from China, a boy from Turkey, a boy from Argentina, and a boy from Italy.
Wow. So it's kind of gone all over the place. So
yeah.
How did you first get involved in this?
Way back in the 70s when I was in high school, we actually hosted an exchange student from Sweden in 74, 75. And it was such a good experience. I always told my kids when they get in high school, you know, we'll host a student. And we did. And it started in 2005. And then we didn't do it for a few years. And then my kids got older and moved out, and I was bored, so I started again.
Now, tell us how this works now. Do they come in at the beginning of a school year and then end of a school year, or is it a full calendar year commitment?
No, it's a 10-month student visa that they come on. Most of them, they can do half years too. There are half year placements also, and they'll come for just one semester at school. But usually they come in mid to late August and leave mid to late June.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Fabian, let's talk to you here a second. Oh, where are you from, first of all, in Germany?
I'm from Berlin.
Oh, you're from Berlin. Now, would you be technically from the East Berlin or the West Berlin?
From the East Berlin, I think.
Yeah, East.
Okay,
yeah.
From the East Berlin side. How did you get interested in saying, you know what, I'd really like to go study in the United States for a little bit?
Yeah, I thought about it a while ago, actually. And I think especially because my sister and her boyfriend did this exchange here too. And okay. They always told me about their experiences and a lot of stories. So I think that's how it worked out.
Kyle, we hosted his sister and our first exchange student just got married.
Is that right?
Yes, and he was the first, his new brother-in-law, Lucas, was our first exchange student.
So Lucas and your sister got married?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And you hosted both of them? Or
no.
Just Lucas?
Actually, they came the same year, but she was through a different program, and she was in New Jersey the same year we had Lucas.
Were they together at the time?
Or? Yes. They actually met at a YFU orientation camp.
Wow.
And they've been together, like, in 2005, and they've pretty much been together ever since.
So Lucas talked her up, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
So how long have you been in the United States?
I think for 3 weeks now.
Okay. What's your first impressions?
It's actually not that much of a difference between Germany, but there are, of course, a lot of new things and a lot of new people to meet. It was very interesting till now.
What did you think about going to a town called Napoleon?
I'm living in a big city, so I was a bit scared at first, but it's not really that hard because, especially with the media today, are not that separated from the other world and can just easily speak at home.
The cows aren't that mean, are they?
No, they aren't.
It's a little different than Berlin, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is.
What about the town called Napoleon? Isn't that kind of interesting?
Yeah, but I don't really think that it has to do much with Napoleon at all.
Oh, it does.
Really does.
Oh, it does.
The person that founded the town really, really was impressed with Napoleon, and that's how it got its name.
Oh, okay.
Bonaparte, yeah.
Wow. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, now we've learned something here on Current State. I didn't know that as well. So you're going to be here until mid-June? Is that the plan? Okay. How has the students in Napoleon responded to you? Have you been able to make friends and so forth?
I don't know if I've been able to make very good friends till now, but I've talked to many people, and they were very nice and open-minded and friendly. And I've been to a few, but no.
You're a junior then right now?
Yes, but I'm doing all the senior stuff.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
So are you 16 then?
I'm 16, yes.
Okay, and you're doing senior stuff. Does that mean that you're doing advanced, are you an advanced student, or is Germany just a bit ahead of us here in the United States?
I don't know. I think the school here is a bit easier than my school in Germany, but my school in Germany is very hard compared to other schools, yeah.
Are you in an advanced school, or is just schools in general in Germany really hard?
I'm kind of in an advanced school, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes us feel a little better anyway. Let's get back to you, Deb. Could you give us a little example of how many students come to Michigan from other countries and how many Michigan kids go off to other countries?
Well, just an example. So in my field, South Central Michigan, we have 19 different countries from 6 different continents represented.
Wow. And we would have all 7 if there was anyone who lived in Antarctica, I suppose.
Exactly. Exactly.
So is it usually more kids coming over or more kids going?
Depends on the year. We bring over about 1,400 kids every year from other countries to the United States. We get probably between 400 and 500 that we place here in Michigan.
Okay. And then as far as kids going overseas, do you have an idea on the numbers of that?
I think it's between like 250 and 300 kids. It could be more. depending on the year again and the number of people who apply to go to other countries.
Do you have a situation where you have more host families interested in bringing in kids, or you have more kids and you have kind of a shortage of families?
We have more kids than we do families.
Is that right?
We're still looking for host families for a few kids who are waiting to start their exchange experience.
For this year?
Yes.
Is that right? Where are they right now?
They're in their home country still.
Wow. And they want to come to the United States, but there is no home parent for them.
There's no host family for them yet that has come forward.
Well, let me go back to you here then, Linda. Tell our listeners, is it hard to be a host parent for these kids?
I don't think so.
Now, do you raise kids? You mentioned you have kids of your own. Mm-hmm. How many kids did you have?
We have two.
Okay.
And I have to make a plug. Our daughter is, her due date was on Sunday, and she's still waiting to have her baby.
Oh, wow. How exciting. So your kids are out. But you say that, you said it was easy. Why is that?
Because I try to stay very open with my expectations. And honestly, with no other kids in the house, I think it's easier for them to acclimate and go make their own friends and not have to worry about the conflict that could happen with other kids in the family. I mean, even when my kids were there, it was great. They all just like got along really well. I mean, but there's always that, get acquainted period where they learn each other's quirks and personalities, and then it just seems to flow.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you still keep in contact with the kids that you've hosted before?
Actually, yes. Most of them I do. We went to Europe for 3 weeks this summer and got to visit several that we hadn't seen. We went for Lucas's and Elisa's wedding.
You did? How exciting.
Yeah.
Wow. So you were able to meet Fabian that time?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Well, that's exciting. And I'm sure when you go to Europe, then you have an opportunity for some free lodging along the way.
We did. I said we went for almost 3 weeks and only paid for 5 nights of a hotel. It was awesome.
Now, that's the way to travel right there. Why should a family consider hosting an exchange student?
Because I think that the world is getting smaller all the time, and we need to learn to deal with other cultures. And we're too insulated. I think our kids are too insulated, and they need to have variety.
Now, Fabian, what would you say to students your age who think they want to do something like this, but they're scared or nervous about it?
It isn't really that hard, especially today. As I already said, with the media, you can easily stay in touch with your family at home and your friends. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of new experiences and other stuff, and I think it's very interesting.
Deb, let's close this out by giving some information on if you'd like to volunteer, how would you go about doing it?
If you'd like to volunteer, you can visit our website. We have a volunteer website located at www.yfuusa.org. You can also look up information on our study abroad programs as well as hosting application.
So it sounds pretty easy. And so if you want to host somebody for this year, mm-hmm. you can still do that.
You can. Yes, absolutely.
Boy, and you could have an exchange student in your house in a couple weeks, I imagine. Eh?
Probably by next week.
Is that right? Things go that quickly.
We do. If the application's in and we do the interviews and we book the flight and get them here so they can start their exchange experience immediately.
Wow, that's really great. Well, Deb Fry, the South Central Michigan Field Coordinator for Youth for Understanding, Linda Unkefer, she's a YFU host mom and volunteer, and Fabian Hainig, Linda's German exchange, quote-unquote, son. Thank you all for joining us on Current State today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. Coming up on Current State, a star-studded event is happening here in Lansing next week with some very familiar names. Dr. Mona Anna Atisha, Ashley Judd, and the woman who started it all, Martha Maynard Mertz. It's the Athena International Leadership Conference, and we'll talk with the former president of Athena's Lansing affiliate, Sarah Jennings, on this program. Plus, attend a rehearsal of the Ioxin Theater's new production, The Amazing Jesus, a Latin American fable from a Lansing playwright, and speak with the artistic director of the theater, Jeff Croft. That and more Thursday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Ken Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond, from politics to education, environmental news to healthcare, science and tech to music and theater, stories from around the state, and your own hometown. That's the Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast. You can stay connected with Current State or Twitter at WKR Current State and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. We'll see you tomorrow.